when I ask an actor to take part in the film, and this film is absolutely no exception, the only exceptions have been the historical film, but I can talk about that separately. I say to an actor, I can't tell anything about the film because we're going to make it up. I can't tell anything about the character because there is no character, because you and I are going to collaborate to create a character. And this is the important thing, you will never know anything except what your character knows. So there's a complete discipline of secrecy, so that nobody ever knows anything that their character wouldn't know, which means that in improvisations, you can have things happen which are completely organic and truthful.
Hey everyone, I'm Billy, and welcome back to Half the Picture. Our guest this episode, I'm delighted to say, is none other than National Treasure, Mike Lee. Originally, it was just going to be Mike chatting to us, but Marion Bailey, Mike's amazing collaborator and partner, was on her way to the dentist at the same time that Mike sat down to chat with us. So Mike suggested that she come and join in as well. So this episode we recorded back in 2022. It's one from our vaults. We recorded it around the time that Mike was getting the financing ready for Hard Truths, his latest film. And we talked a little bit about his difficulties getting that off the ground and the general state of the industry at that time, the film industry. I had just started the podcast as a student endeavor with my friend Ahmed, who features in the episode. Something else I should say. This episode is an audio-only entry of the podcast. So luckily, you don't have to see my massive baby face yakking on to Mike Lee and fanboying to him for the best part of an hour. We had so much fun chatting to Mike and Marion on this episode and chatting all things about All or Nothing, but also some of Mike's other films like Naked and Mean Time, Secrets and Lies, and I can't wait to share it with you guys. We also touched on Mike's rather unique way of making films, which I'm sure some of you guys might know about, his improvisational methods of writing a script with the actors and through rehearsals. And we also talked a little bit about what advice to give filmmakers starting out today, as well as his experience working with the cast on All or Nothing specifically. So, you know, you've got Tim Spall, Leslie Manville, Sally Hawkins. I mean, so many national treasures. And you've got all of that and more to look forward to. So, without further ado, let's roll on my chat with Mike Lee and Marion Bailey. Enjoy.
How are you doing then, Mike? You okay?
I'm okay. I mean, we've had massive struggles getting film backing. And I don't know whether you saw today's news. It's about Batgirl. Have you read that? $100 million worth. And they're not going to release it because they don't. It didn't stand up to audience tests. You know, now I really wanted something like 15 to 20 million, which has turned out to be really impossible. And it looks as though we're probably going to make a low budget film for under 5 million. Now, can you imagine how many independent films could be made for that amount of bread that's been wasted on Batgirl? I mean, I worked out. If every film was had as much as $20 million, which is really adequate to do really interesting things, that's 50 independent films down the drain. I'm really pissed off about it, really. I am. Money is poured into the big pictures. Not only does that take the money away, but also it's very hard to get facilities and crews because everybody's making money on the big thing. However, having said that, we are going to make a low-budget movie. There you go. I haven't come here to whinge, so back to you.
Excellent. Great news that you've got another project on the go. So, so today we'll be talking about All or Nothing, which is now 20 years old. I mean, looking back on the film from 20 years distance, what's your personal feeling about the film compared to your other work and also in terms of like how it first came out and how it was received?
Well, it wasn't received very well. I mean, one of my main feelings about it is precisely that it was, to some degree, not only neglected, but some people were quite rude about it and said it was relentlessly, tediously pessimistic, which of course is rubbish. It actually has definite elements of optimism in it. But anyway, it's in the nature of my work and the way it gets made and all the rest of it. I quite like all my films, really. I mean, there are not really many where I'd say, I don't really like it or I don't have any negative feelings about it. And I'm very fond of it, you know, and there are moments in it that I cherish. I mean, I do have to say, I do love all the stuff in the car with the lady from France. And nobody says very much about Alison Garland's performance as Rachel. It's an amazing, wonderful performance, really subtle and real and, you know, all that stuff. I can't answer a question particularly. I mean, I'm very fond of it and I'm glad it's been spotted, as with you, that it's its 20th anniversary.
Well, I think it's a brilliant film of yours. And actually, it's funny that you bring up Alison Garland because I was thinking about her of Rachel, that character, when I was watching it again. That when one of your films finishes, you are left to think about it in terms of where could those characters be where are they going to go after that? And there's a real sense of optimism in that ending. But then with that character, you know, she's sitting there and obviously the attention is on Phil and Penny and James Corden's character. But at first, she's very quiet. She's still withdrawn. Yeah. And it's like, and I was wondering as I was watching, like, oh, you know, hopefully something will give there, you know, that she'll find a voice.
I agree. And actually, I mean, there is no doubt that that scene at the end is positive about Phil and Penny and it's positive about Rory. She knows stuff. She knows what's gone. And she, you know, you see her cogitating. And yeah, it's a question, you know. And I do like to leave questions unanswered for my people, for the audience to take away and ponder.
Yeah, you almost think that, you know, if something does give, it might not be because even though Phil and Penny are in a better space and Rory as well, you think maybe for Rachel, it will have to come from outside of the family. Maybe, yeah, something will happen.
She needs to find a bloke, really.
Yeah. I think that's it. Yeah, you might. I think you're onto something there. Absolutely. Brilliant. So the conceptual starting point for All or Nothing, because as I say, your movies from one to the other tend to vary quite dramatically in tone. You know, something like Hard Labor, which is then followed by Nuts in May, which is very different to Hard Labor. You've got Naked, which is very different tonally to Life is Sweet. And then An All or Nothing is very different from the film that came before it, Topsy Turvy. And I was wondering, the conceptual starting point for All or Nothing, did you feel a need to go back to the streets, as it were?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, having done Topsy Turvy in a pretty obvious way, I thought, okay, now let's go back, exactly what you said, let's go back to the streets, let's look at what's happening, you know. And that was the starting point, was, you know, how tough it was for a lot of working class people, you know, as simple as that. That's the starting point, sure.
Mm. So I'd like to ask a bit about the casting process for the film. And I wanted to ask, at what point did you realise that, you know, that Marion and Tim and Leslie and a lot of your regulars, your veterans that you've worked with before, what was the point at which you knew that those actors were the ones that you wanted to use?
Well, I mean, that's a question with no remarkable answer. The point was when I decided to invite them to do it. I mean, the creative process, you can't always log the exact accumulation of decisions. But to begin with, I knew that I was going to put Leslie and Tim Spore together as a couple. Now, as I often do, I did a very open set of auditions where the casting director, Nina Gold, who's a brilliant casting director, would bring in all sorts of people that she discovered or knew about. Two of the people who came in for their auditions were James, who now rules the world, as you know, and Alison Garland. Now, you'd have to have been dumb not to spot that they could play brother and sister, because they're both quite tubby. And I knew that Tim Spall, who at that time was also tubby, was going to be the dad. And so that suggested that. And hence you've got James and Alison playing these tubby kids. It's the first time I came across Sally Hawkins. And she was obviously brilliant. So I got her in and it went from there, really. And, you know, it's hard to say any more about it than that. It's when one embarks on the project with a whole lot of possibilities, but it's still open as to, you know, how you're going to deploy people. It sort of grows organically.
So Marion, I mean, talking about this film specifically, because obviously you've done so much with Mike, so much great work with this film, what were your sort of conversations with Mike about the character that you played? Because when I was watching it, I was reminded a little bit of the character you played in Meantime, very slightly. There's a shot in Meantime at the end of, like, I think it's your last shot of the film, where you're sitting there and you're arguing with Melina.
When she's hit the gin.
Yeah, she's hit the gin and she's got tears running down her face and she tells him to fuck off. And as I was watching All or Nothing, I kind of thought, it, obviously, the characters are very different, but if you took a snapshot of your face at the end of that scene and sort of flung it 20 years into the future, you would have something that maybe quite close to resembling.
That's interesting. That's interesting because, as you, I'm sure, know, Mike always gets the actors to start off with either a source character or, in both cases, they were an amalgam of three people I've actually known in my life, none of whom coincided, by the way. You know, the three characters that I used as, it's only a starting point. You move away from those source characters as you work with Mike. But the starting point of the three people I had for Auntie Barbara were different people to the people I had in my mind for Carol. But interestingly, I suppose what they had in common, now you mention it, and I've really never thought about this before, but as I was creating their life history with Mike, they were both what I described as daddy's girls. They've both grown up as quite pretty, quite intelligent, wanting to please their father. In the case of Carol, her background history was that she had an older brother who died, I think, in a car accident, as I remember. And that sort of ruined her relationship with her father. He never got over it, really. And she tried too hard to please him. And she grew up trying to please men. She was, you know, male deferred to an extreme extent. And she'd met her Ronnie, played by wonderful Paul Jessen. You know, he seemed to her everything that a man should be, kind of masculine and a hard worker. And she wanted to be the little woman and not go out to work. And she was, when she was younger, very pretty. And Barbara, on the other hand, in the meantime, was intelligent and did want to go to work. She wanted to be a bank manager, actually, but because she had a slight London accent in those days, and I did all the research into this, shockingly, everyone I spoke to who worked in the city and remembered those days said, oh, if she had a slight London accent, no way would she ever have been allowed to progress beyond sitting behind the counter in a bank. I feel more optimistic about Auntie Barbara's future than Carol's future. I think Carol was or became an alcoholic. I don't think Barbara would have done. She was just having a very bad moment and she hit the gin. I feel she probably could have escaped that marriage and got on with her life. I think Carol was beyond redemption, bless her.
Yeah, it's a fate that you kind of dread for some of the other characters in the film All or Nothing. And, you know, they're all sort of trapped in codependent relationships. I mean, as I was watching, because I know that you and Mike, and not only you, Mike, but like, you know, all the actors, there's a really thorough amount of research done into your characters. And I assume you guys had reasons for like, okay, this is what happened to her at one point with, and this is why she turned to drinking. And it was all there in the foundations.
Yes. And I remember at one stage, however, because when we started rehearsals, as I was working through it, she had quite a sexy little walk. She was on top of things. She felt, you know, they had a lovely, beautiful daughter. She felt life was pretty good. And I remember there was a certain point in rehearsals when Mike wasn't what he ultimately wanted. And I was being pushed into making her more of a wreck, you know, the wreck that she became. You know, you don't just walk into a room and he says, okay, I think I want her to be more broken down than this. It's all done by talking about the character and what becomes of her and what her life situation is. Of course, as their marriage went along, it wasn't successful. He'd sort of fallen out of love. She became more needy. The daughter was a bit of a brat and she couldn't handle it. And her dreams of an idyllic domestic life didn't work out. And that's how ultimately or destroyed her, really. So there wasn't much research to be done. I mean, I do enjoy a drink, but you know, that was about it. There wasn't in terms of like, you know, someone like Auntie Barbara who worked in banking and that, you know, there was a lot of research to do there. But obviously for Carol, her life was simply sitting in front of a mirror, putting on makeup, having a drink, going out with the girls. That was the high point of her life. And even then, you know, they put up with her, bless her. And going out in character, yes, I just sort of wander around charity shops and markets to buy cheap clothes. But she really wanted to be more than cheap clothes and jewellery. She wanted to be gorgeous. And her gorgeousness was fading, had faded by the time you meet her in the film. So you know, it was interesting how we came to that stage of her life, how we went through that process. But it was done organically and talking to me, the actor, about what happened to the character and life's disappointments. The relationship with the other two women, as I remember, that was her absolute only lifeline. But of course, she wasn't the best of friends because she was so threatened, really, by other women. So on the one hand, she did that thing that people do when they're drunk. On the one hand, saying, oh, you're so gorgeous. I love you so much. And oh, do you love me? Do you love me? How much do you love me? I really love you. Which I suppose drove them mad. And then the next minute being viciously bitchy. But somehow they put up with her. And of course, they were neighbours. And so there wasn't a necessary network. And when she was younger, she was probably fun, a good time girl, good fun to go out with. It was only as the years went by, you know, you hear them talking about her at the beginning of the film, saying, well, I suppose you better invite Carol. So they held her aloft in a way. But I would imagine, if you were to sort of see those three characters further down the line, the other two women have a lot going for them. I love the relationship with the next door, with the girl who's pregnant. And, you know, she's so wonderful, that mother. exactly the sort of mother you'd want in those circumstances. And I felt quite optimistic about Leslie Manville's character and her marriage by the end. You know, they've had that huge trauma of the son who's had a heart attack, and a few home truths have been spoken. I always feel very optimistic for that family by the end. I think it's actually got a happy ending, the film, because, you know, he's going to start eating more sensibly and they're going to start looking after each other more as a family. You know, she had needs that weren't met. He had needs that weren't met. The children had needs that weren't met. Their lives were never going to get better financially, possibly. But, you know, between themselves, I think they were going to be able to cope better. So the only family that really hit the buffers was Carol and Ron's family. Even so, though, you know, lovely Sally Hawkins, who played our daughter, she's had a bit of a wake-up call by the end. And I think she is going to climb upwards in life, hopefully. You know, there's some hope for her, but probably not much hope for Lonnie and Carol.
Well, yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, you know, you really do get the impression that Sally Hawkins, despite the fact that she's bored in this environment, you know, that she's practical. You know, she could.
Yes. I remember doing the improvisation when he has the heart attack, and my character sort of goes upstairs and has been told to go and phone an ambulance. And of course, she's not capable of doing that. She stood there absolutely incapacitated. And I remember Mike having to actually, after about 20 minutes, I don't know, had gone by, stopped the improvisation and said, okay, she's not going to be able to make that phone call, is she? And I said, no, she hasn't got the wherewithal anymore to be practical and make that decision. You know, and she was very similar to her daughter when she was young. Yes, there was that practical side, as you're quite right, to Sally's character.
You have to go.
I have to go. It was very nice to talk to you both. Yeah.
Absolute pleasure, Marion. Thank you.
Yeah.
What an unexpected pleasure. Thank you.
Well done. You could hardly have prepared questions for her.
That was amazing. Thank you. Yeah, we're a bit, like I say, we're big fans.
No, good. Thank you for that. That was great.
No, that was great.
An added bonus.
Excellent. So I was wanted to ask a little bit about your methods in making a film, which is famously done through a lot of improvisation with the actors and rehearsals, rather than just sitting down and writing a script. And I know that you get asked about your method an awful lot, and I don't want to press the point, but I was just wondering if you could give us a brief rundown, an idea of it.
Yes, all right. Well, basically, the first and most important thing for everyone to get their head around is when we talk about improvisation, it's not improvised on camera. By the time it gets in front of the camera, it's very structured, very scripted, very precise, but remains organic. First of all, we spend months, as we did on All or Nothing, in the rehearsal situation where I sit down individually with each actor and we get the characters on the go by basing them on real people that the actors talk about to start with. Then we put them together and we start to build up through improvisation, discussion, quite a lot of research where it's appropriate and necessary, so that you build this whole world, this whole microcosm. I mean, obviously, my job as dramatist, if you like, a filmmaker, is to be putting it together and pushing it and pulling it in a direction so that what we arrive at is the premise for a film. We don't rehearse the precise content of the film in that whole period. At the end of that period, I will write a sort of structure in a very provisional way, not least because it's necessary from the point of view of the organization of the film from a practical filming and design point of view. And then scene by scene, sequence by sequence, location by location, we have rehearsals without the crew where I will start with the actors improvising in the location. And then we'll, through rehearsal, we'll script the scenes, always doing it through rehearsing, not by me going away and writing it down on bits of paper and bringing it back until we arrive at the precise ones. Then the crew will rejoin us and we will shoot the scenes. And we are, from my point of view, and indeed from everybody's point of view, we are actually, in strict terms, still making a film up as we go along. And there have been a whole bunch of my films, including this one, where we'd shot a lot of the film before we knew how it was really going to end. Obviously, there are certain kinds of dramaturg tricks for example, in this film, James Corden said to me one day, nothing seems to be happening. It's the same thing. I said, look, hold on to that. And then one day I said, now look, we're going to make an advanced decision, you and I, which nobody else will know about. And by the way, I should have said this. one of the key things that makes it all work is that when I ask an actor to take part in the film, and this film is absolutely no exception, the only exceptions have been the historical film, but I can talk about that separately. I say to an actor, I can't tell anything about the film because we're going to make it up. I can't tell anything about the character because there is no character, because you and I are going to collaborate to create a character. And this is the important thing, you will never know anything except what your character knows. So there's a complete discipline of secrecy, so that nobody ever knows anything that their character wouldn't know, which means that in improvisations, you can have things happen which are completely organic and truthful. So I sat down with James Corden and said, "Now, okay, between you and me, he's going to have a heart attack." And of course, we knew that we were dealing with a fat boy who eats badly and et cetera and sits around all day and all that. He was obviously a candidate for a coronary condition. And so you're going to be researching heart attack. And so we did that. Nobody else knew about it. So it meant when we do the heart attack, which we did there, out there where you see it and everything, and did the improvisations, it was a proper shock. And it was a shock all the way down the line. And I think I invented the idea that our taxi driver should, after his experience with that rather formidable French lady, who, by the way, you know, that's Catherine Hunter, who plays the witch in the recent film Macbeth the Movie.
Yes, she's amazing.
Amazing actress. I had this idea that he would just bugger off out of town and turn his mobile off and disappear. And then we have this extraordinary idea that he would actually go down to where he goes, which you probably recognize. So all these things are set up in order to explore and exacerbate the situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's beautifully done. And relating to what you said about how that is very much the prep stage, so when I was watching All or Nothing again, there's such beautifully designed shots in the movie that you and Dick Pope capture. And like, there's a couple of examples that jump to mind. So that incredible push in on Leslie and Tim at the end when they reconcile, that, you know, that beautiful shot. And then there's the shot where Craig and Sally Hawkins' character, they share that kiss. And then the camera, there's like a symmetry to the shot. Like they come round one side of the estate and then, you know, it's a tracking shot and she goes around the other side. It's like they're beautifully choreographed. And I was wondering when that starts. Yeah, that prep.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the key thing is my relationship with Dick Pope. I mean, he has shot all of my films, as you all know, since Life is Sweet. And no doubt you've seen all the films, including Peter Lou.
Yes, I have seen all your films. Big fan.
When it came to... that's why we're here. Okay.
That's why.
On Peter Lou, just to digress for a moment, everybody on the production team started to say, we really ought to think about having a storyboard artist for this. It's really important because this is going to be very different from what you've done before, you know. And I said, no way. Absolutely no way, because we know how we work. We set up the action, we look at the action, and then we decide on what, based on what we can see, how to shoot them. Yeah, no, it'll be different because it'll be too complicated. And, you know, even Dick said, you know, maybe we should think about it. And I said, if you have a storyboard artist, he or she will spend all the time in the caravan or in hospital because I've broken their legs. And we didn't have a storyboard artist. Now, the point about this is that the way we work, Dick Pope and I, is absolutely organic. I mean, you know, if you're talking about All or Nothing, I would have prepared the action in the location in the way that I've described, and then he will join in, and then we'll look at it and decide how we're going to shoot. The tracking shot where it moves in on their intimate moment across the room, that was a really difficult tracking shot because, first of all, it had to track completely silently across this apartment. In the shot, if you go back and look at it, you'll see that there's a table with stuff on it next to where he's sitting. That was in the way of the dolly. So very discreetly, at a certain rehearsed point, the prop guys had to remove the table and the stuff on it silently as the camera moved in. That's a really elaborate kind of stuff. And you referred to another... Oh, yeah, the tracking shot at night with the two kids around the garage. And yeah, I mean, we've often thought, do we track here? No, we don't need to track. Shouldn't track. It's got to have something to say. It's got to have a meaning. It's got to be organic above all things. And so we work it out with a very brilliant team of guys around the camera and you get the results, really.
Mm, and they're beautiful. And so the idea for those shots, that is not in the prep or rehearsal stage. That is in the sheet.
No, I may. A number of different things can go on. First of all, I set up the action and I construct it. Now, in doing so, inevitably, while I'm doing so, I'm thinking provisionally, cinematically, because I know I'm making a film. So Dick will join in when I've got to the right point with the crew, and we'll run this action for the crew. And I may say, I think it's this. And he may well say, absolutely, no, I can see that. Let's put lights on it. Let's do it. Or equally likely is that I may say, it's here. And he may say, yep, I can see that. But actually, I was standing over there. Or if we did it there, the light's better. So we'll then negotiate it and work it out. And the actors stay with us and they'll run bits for us. And there are scenes, especially when you get longer sequences, where I will work out the action without actually working out shots in advance. And then we'll then break the action down and go through it and work out our plan. And occasionally, of course, there are certain things that happen where certain kinds of locations, I mean, I suppose in the hospital or something, I don't know, where you haven't got a choice of shooting every angle. You know, you've got to make, you go on a recce to look at the location and you know that you've got to shoot in a certain direction. And so, or it's got to be lit. It can only be lit. Lighting can only go in a certain place. So that makes a decision for you, but that's fine. You know, that's another part of the cinematic decision-making equation.
Mm. Well, it's fascinating. And so it's clear from your films that you're not interested particularly, it seems to me, in making these explicit, simplistic political statements to an audience. You keep that stuff very much implicit and under the surface of the story and the drama. And I was curious, so as I was watching All or Nothing, I was thinking back to things like Mean Time, Naked, and even Happy-Go-Lucky to some extent, in the sense that, like, there's an idea in the films to me that there's education and then there's working class characters, like the characters that you find in All or Nothing, like Sally Hawkins's character, because they're undernourished perhaps by lack of education. They haven't really got the opportunity, despite being practical and clear, you know, capable of real intelligence, to get out there and escape from where they are. And I was wondering, do you sort of see All or Nothing as being a continuation of that idea?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's obvious that Johnny in Naked is a victim of the education system, in the sense that there's a really bright guy who you could comfortably say could or should have gone to university, etc. But you know that he was chucked out of the classroom all the time by his teachers, given a hard time, instead of them encouraging him and nourishing him. The flip side of Johnny, I always think, is Poppy, who you referred to in Happy Go Lucky, who obviously has got the same kind of anarchy and sardonic humour as Johnny, but and they're both idealists. But he's a frustrated idealist and she's an idealist who does something with it. You're right in saying that the kids in All or Nothing, none of them are thick. You know, they're all bright, but it's been wasted. You know, they haven't been stimulated or, you know, taken seriously or given an opportunity and so on. So, I think you're absolutely right. But it is implicit, you know, and in some ways it would be wrong for me to say or imply that I'd sort of thought this is a film about education, because in a way it's implicit in the whole condition of their lives, these characters' lives that we're looking at, and that's part of that.
And I think it's fascinating that theme does come up again and again in your work. And I love the fact that in Happy Go Lucky, you made a film which is, as you say, it's the flip side. It's the positive, you know, it's like this is, Poppy's a teacher who is really practical and generous and is great at her job. She's a great teacher. So I love these contrasts in the way you go into it. So a fact that some people may or may not know about your films as well is that they remain untitled until quite late in the game. You don't start off with a title like All or Nothing and then you go, okay, we're going to make All or Nothing. You sort of develop it and then it takes form. And I was wondering, at what point did All or Nothing suggest itself as a title? And did you have any other ideas for this?
Well, I mean, look, the point is this. They never have a title. The only exception was Peterloo, because we knew it was about the Peterloo Massacre, so we called it Peterloo. And that's the only film I've made which wasn't called Untitled at the year it was made. So All or Nothing was called Untitled 01, because it was made in 2001. And there's no way you would know what they're going to be called, because you don't know what the film is. As late as possible in the post-production stage, and really it's in time for the guy to do the graphics, I finally under pressure to sit down and decide what the hell to call the film. So it's as late in the day as possible. that I decide on the title, and that's the answer to your question. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Speaking of post-production, I was hoping to ask you a bit about that. So this is the second film that you've edited digitally, I believe, on Avid, after Topsy Turvy was the first. You'd obviously edited all your previous films before Topsy Turvy on analog methods, and you did, I think even in the credits, you have edited on real film at the end of the credits of your films. Did you feel more comfortable with digital on this film, second time around?
It's interesting. I mean, well, we were going to edit Topsy Turvy on a Steinbeck analog, and one day during the shoot of Topsy Turvy, and you're familiar with Topsy Turvy,
yeah,
we were in the doing the theatre stuff at Richmond. This massive stuff with all these actors on stage in all these very, very thick, cumbersome Mikado costumes, and the whole orchestra and people in the audience and lighting in, and it was a fantastically hot summer, and people were grumbling, and we were behind schedule, and everything was really tough. It was lunchtime, and my late producer, Simon Channing Williams, suddenly materialized with Robin Sales, the editor, and they said, "We need to talk to you. We've got an issue." I said, "Okay, so let's go behind this bus." So I went behind the bus, and they said, "For financial reasons, we're going to have to edit this film on Avid." And I said, "I'll tell you what, I don't care what we edit it on, because at the moment, the job is just to get this thing shot." It's interesting to think back to that, because what you got was, this is the weird thing about that stage of the transition from one mode of working to the next, was that the point is this: it is a tool. And I was in Hollywood doing press for, I think, Secrets and Lies. And there was a massive industry screening in a big cinema packed with film workers. And somebody said, "You know, we've got a pair of scissors on the end of your film. Why are you so committed to editing on film?" And I made this speech about, you know, the thing about editing on film is it gives you time to think. The trouble with digital editing is there's no time to think, all this. And some people clapped and cheered and said, "Great." Now I look back on it, having cut a whole number of films digitally. Bullshit. Complete bullshit. I mean, it's saving a fortune in second-hand books, because I used to, you know, be in the cutting room and they'd say, "Okay, well, we need to look at 196 take 5. And then they'd say, "Okay, well, give us an hour. Give us an hour and a half. And we'll find the trim," you know, so they have to sort it all. And so I'd go wandering around Charing Cross Road and go into the second-hand bookshops and spend some more money. But suddenly, you know, you want to see 196 take 4 and you go, and it's there, you know. So the idea that editing the old-fashioned way was in some way better or more creative is rubbish, basically. The tool is there to be used. I don't look back on my 15 or 16 or whatever it is films, and I don't in any way in my head differentiate between those we cut in one mode or those we cut in the later mode, because in the end we've done it with the same cinematic spirit and the same sense of what it's all about, and it's merely they're just tools to be used. So that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, quite right. And sticking with the editing theme, so your films, you're concerned with your films with the rhythms of everyday life and everyday people, and less with percussive quick rhythms that you find in like an action movie or like a sports movie, you know, which are very quick and cut. And there's an idea that I think me and Ahmed have come across in our studies, which is the really action-packed scenes are the hardest ones to edit. And in our experience, I think we'd say that they're not, because the rhythms where you cut are much more obvious because it's much more percussive and quick. And I was wondering, like, when you're editing your movies, do you find them at all, are they at all challenging to edit because of the fact that you're focusing in on sort of much subtler, quieter rhythms and language?
I mean, certainly it's subtler. When we're shooting, I mean, sometimes I will say, okay, and you get a really brilliant piece of acting and emotional stuff going on. And I say, "Let's go again." And people say, "Well, why are we going again? That was great." And I say, "Well, I don't know. Let's see what happened." And you shoot it. And when we get to the cutting room, and we really start sifting through, you've got nuances. It's about nuances of behavior, nuances of rhythm and emotional strengths and, you know, all those things. So that is obviously a zillion miles away from the kind of action movie cutting. And in that sense, you're right. In that sense, it's more obvious when you're cutting action movie stuff. We're not concerned with the subtleties and nuances of emotional behavior and subtext, we're talking about, you know, just what happens. So it's horses for courses, actually. I mean, you know, the famous scene, I guess, in one of my films is in Secrets and Lies, when the mother and the daughter meet for the first time and they go and sit in a cafe. You know that scene?
Yeah.
And it holds up for 8.5 minutes in one single two shot. When we did it, I think we did 3 or 4 takes. And then we, as you naturally would, went in on it and did reverses. And when we got to the cutting and we looked at it, we realized that actually cutting in on it took something away from it. And that one of the takes was so perfect that you really would be mad to mess with it, really, because it was all going on and you're drawn into it precisely because there are no tricks, you know. So it varies. But I mean, if you look at Peterloo, obviously what we've done there, I mean, in the end, when it gets to the massacre, we shot it with 3 cameras and we didn't storyboard. We built the action in the organic way that we always do. But we were working with all those great range of elements of all shapes and sizes, people running around on horses and, you know, violence and all the rest of it. And, you know, it's very much editor's material. The great editor, John Gregory, who cut that film and a whole bunch of others, unfortunately died last year prematurely. I mean, he spent ages in that cutting room sorting out the Peterloo stuff. And, you know, what would happen with John? He'd say, okay, look, I've done something. I'm going to show it to you. If you don't like it, I'll take it apart, put it back to how it was. But you'll have to see what you think. And sometimes I might say, amazing, you're really, really advanced. And sometimes I might say, you know what, I don't agree with this because X, Y, Z, and then fine. So it's collaboration is the important thing. In the end, there is no getting away from the fundamental fact of life, which is that all films are made in the cutting room, all films. It is about what happens in the edit. It really, really is.
Mm. Okay, so moving on to another one of your collaborators, you know, who you worked with several times, Andrew Dixon, and the score for the film, which is really interesting and it's beautiful. And as I was listening to it back, I was thinking, you know, it felt like an organic continuation, if you like, of what you guys had did on Naked and Secrets and Lies. You know, there's a lot of strings, there's double basses and violas, but with All or Nothing, you have, you know, these extra elements like flutes and acoustic guitars and, you know, these different instruments come into the mix. And I was just curious what kind of conversations you and Andrew had about the music. And, you know, did you suggest things like that to him?
No. First of all, the important thing, so far as I'm concerned, is that I only do work with composers who start from their own emotional reaction to the material. In other words, of course, there are plenty of composers who compose generic movie music. And I'm not interested in that at all. I mean, it's about working with composers who have a voice, but who also can start from what they feel about what's happening dramatically and emotionally. And with Andrew, he collects old quirky instruments and he's got a completely original take on it all. He will come up with suggestions for the voice of the film, the instruments, on the whole composers do. I mean, when we did Naked, he had this idea for using a harp. Actually, the harp that's played in the score on Naked is played by a very famous harpist called Skylar Kangar. He got in touch with her, and Skylar lives in 2 houses in North London, 2 semi-detached houses. She lives in one, and the other one's full of harps. And we spent a whole day in the harp house, going around listening to different kinds of harps that she's got. For Vera Drake, which he composed the score for, he had this idea, appropriate to the subject matter of the film, that the score should include children's voices. And he recorded some stuff with some kids, and it didn't quite work because of the limitation of children's voices. So he followed the idea through, and we have that idea on the score, but he got a women's choir to do it rather than kids because they've got a greater resonance and more workable with voices. So for All or Nothing, yeah, he made those decisions or suggestions, and then we test them and try them, and I might make suggestions. In the end, again, it's what I said about the editing. I mean, it's about working with a creative person whose input is personal.
And so with the exception of Topsy Turvy, I think, which has, you know, obviously a huge, you know, orchestra behind it to put on Gilbert and Sullivan, you tend to use quite small groups of musicians for your film scores, around sort of 5 to 8 people, I think is kind of the average maybe. And
Is that purely a budgetary decision, or would you prefer smaller groups?
Well, the two things are related. It is budgetary, but it's not. It would be wrong to say it's just budgetary. The whole principle of making these things is to cut our cloth according to its length. You referred to Andrew's score for Meantime. Well, that was tap piano, as I say, a piano with drawing pins put in the hammers, and a saxophone, two instruments. There's no doubt that that's as much as was possible, but it's fine because that's what we did. Whereas it would have been eccentric to try and record the music for Topsy Turvy, which Carl Davis composed, drawing in completely from the works of Sullivan. It would have been mad to do it other than with a full-scale orchestra. You know, it would be seriously eccentric. So that was budgeted for of necessity. But in the end, it's about being imaginative within what's possible.
Brilliant. So that kind of covers everything we wanted to ask about All or Nothing. But we had a couple of, if you've got a bit of time, Mike, we had a couple of bonus questions, I suppose.
Yeah, sure.
I know in the 1960s, you lived off Tottenham Court Road when Richard Lester and the Beatles were making Hard Day's Night. And I was
right outside where I live. Yeah, literally in the same club.
Yeah, I was just like, what was that like? And didn't I hear you say that there was a shot of your flat in the movie, I think, so you're all
there? Oh, yeah, there is. It wasn't a whole flat. It was a room. We all had rooms in this building. The building is still there. But the old Scala Theatre, which was pulled down and replaced by what was then Channel 4, and it's now been pulled down and replaced by something else, that was right outside. It's in Charlotte Street, and the stage door was in Tottenham Street, which is the street I lived in. And I went and watched it being filmed. You know, it was very exciting. I mean, wild schoolgirls ran round and round the block all the time, screaming because the Beatles.
I mean, Ahmed was saying to me the other day that when we were running through these questions, and he said, when like a production blocks like a road for like an hour, it's annoying. But like having the Beatles making a movie must have been insane.
Well, it was, but I was simultaneously at that time on the foundation course at Camberwell Art School and at the London Film School in the evening. And the London Film School was also around the corner in the same spot. So it was all going on. I mean, for me, it was just all part of what was happening, really, you know.
Incredible. So this next question I've kind of wondered about for a while now, I don't know if it's a trivial question or not, but there's a scene in Naked, which to me is quite enigmatic. And I don't know if it should be enigmatic, but there's the scene where Johnny and Gina McKee meet up, and Johnny goes around to Gina McKee's, the flat that she's staying in with the couple, you know, the gay couple have gone to America. And over the course of that scene, you see her character start to crack up and kind of break a bit. And then there comes a moment where she stands up and, you know, and Johnny is being Johnny, but, you know, he's not being Johnny as he is in some of the other characters in the film, you know, more acerbic. And there's a moment where Gina McKee's character stands up and she throws his stuff down the stairs and tells him to leave, which he does eventually. But there's a moment where he says, you know, there are some things that you never understand, you know. And every time that a friend of mine watched that film, we've always wondered that, you know, what is it about the atmosphere with her that makes her suddenly seem to just turn and go, okay, I want you to go. We've always kind of wondered about that scene. I don't know if it is enigmatic, but I was wondering when we're doing that scene, what was the thought process for why she suddenly gets up and...
Well, I'm sorry to say that we knew exactly what was going on. But my job with these things is we hand it over to you. I mean, it's for you to decide. I mean, when that film was shown at the New York Film Festival, and there was a Q&A immediately after the screening, an old guy stood up and he said, Mr. Lee, he said, will Johnny be dead within an hour of the end of the film? And I said, I don't know. It's up to you to decide. The film ends at this point and I hand it over to you. So it is enigmatic, but it's there for you to reflect on. And when he goes back to her flat that she's flat-sitting, you assume probably that he's going to behave in a sexually demonstrative way like he has with other women, but he doesn't for whatever reason. I mean, we knew what the motivation was, and she obviously has trapped in all kinds of stuff that she's been through. And there's a moment when she suddenly doesn't want to, he says, well, I'll just kip down on the sofa, and suddenly there's a moment she doesn't want, you know, for whatever that's about, she wants to decide that this is not going to work out, and she wants to get rid of him, and that's what happens. But it's for you to reflect on the possibilities, not for me to explain it.
Of course, yeah. And I think what's really fascinating about that scene is that in the structure of the film, after she sort of throws him out in a sense, and yeah, asks him to leave. And she's such a quiet, nice, you know, she has a nice face, as he says, a nice smile. And when a character like that tells Johnny to leave, and after that, all the stuff happens after that is, you know, the mugging and the beating of the guy with the van, and it just gets worse for him after that. So it, for me, when I was watching, I was thinking, oh, it's almost like a barometer. It's like, after this.
Well, there you are. Well, you see, you've answered your own question.
Yeah.
So Ahmed wants to jump in as a with one last question. That's
okay. Hi, Mike. What advice would you give to young creatives, especially given the present political society we have in terms of arts funding and so on? What advice would you give to young people standing up? What would be the one thing that you'd sort of try and instill upon them?
Well, in two words, never compromise. That is it. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, that's the long and the short of it.
I mean, that says all, doesn't it?
So that wraps up basically all the questions we had for you, Mike. You've been an absolute pleasure to listen to. We've just sort of sat here and just been like, wow, you know, listen to what you have to say.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and good luck to everybody.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to my chat with Mike Lee and Marion Bailey. And stay tuned for more exciting interviews and guests coming soon on Half the Picture.